Welcome back. This is session 19 of a class on making and preaching sermons. That means you're over halfway, so this is a good thing today. Now, just a review of where we've been. The last time we talked about introductions, and we talked about story as a way to do introductions. In fact, introductions are the hook, and I mentioned then how important introductions are, that you've got about 2 minutes or less in order to hook people's attention before they'll pay attention to the rest of it. And nowadays, you know, you'll see people taking out phones because they're bored, and we're going to reflect on introductions again today. The last time we saw how a story is a magnificent way of hooking people's attention and grabbing them into your introduction. And stories are a way that Jesus used. You know, he would introduce stories like the parable of the sower and then use that as a way to go on and explain how, in the message part of it, how these things got established, how the word gets established in people's hearts and the different reactions to it. But it started with a story. Now, the point of introductions, again, are these things. You want to capture people's attention. You want to establish rapport with the audience, especially this is not from preaching so much. This is a communications image here. Establish rapport. If you haven't talked to this audience before, you want them to get to know you and you want them to get to experience you. And so you establish rapport and you prepare for the purpose. I'm going to repeat those this week and next week, or this session and next session as we go on. That equals a strong beginning as these three things happen: capturing attention, establishing rapport, and preparing for the purpose of your message. Now, last time, again, we looked at story. Today, we're going to look at another one, and that is an intriguing question can grab people's attention, can hook them into your message. There are many people who are tremendously gifted at this. One is this man here. Now, he is not so much a speaker. He does a lot of speaking. He does preaching. His name is Philip Yancey. His very first book was entitled, Where is God When It Hurts? And he introduced that book with a story about a young woman, young mother. She's a wife, she's a mother, and she discovers she has leukemia. She's got a form of leukemia and is in the hospital experiencing treatment. And the treatment is causing her to lose her hair. The chemotherapy is causing her to feel pain in various places, nausea, etc. And people from her church come and give her advice. Not just listening to her pain, but some say, you know, you must really tick God off. Another person comes and says, oh, you know what? God's just calling you and he's giving you a privilege to suffer in his name. Another is saying, you know, you just got to praise God and it'll go away. Another is saying, if you just had faith, you could be healed. And, you know, those are the kind of questions that then lead into, why? Where is God when it hurts? What does the Bible say? So that was his first book, and since then he's written many, many books, and he still uses this method of questions as the introduction. Why is this young woman sick? Name is Claudia. Why is she sick? Now, I'm going to share with you a video. Now, this is not him preaching, but it's him interviewing with another pastor at on a Sunday morning during the service. And you'll notice, we're just going to do 9 minutes, he talks about that first book, Where is God and It Hurts. But then he talks about an introduction to the further point of what he wants to say in that morning. And the introduction tells about the time when he is in an auto accident. And he's told that if he gets airlifted, he's got to be airlifted to another place, and he may die en route. And so he is 7 hours sitting there knowing that this may be the end of his life. And he's given a cell phone and say, you better call those people you love and tell them you love them, because you may not survive the airlift because of the change in pressure, etc. Now, listen to the questions he asks in that situation, and then we'll come back and analyze it.
It is a great honor and a privilege to have the Yanceys with us. Philip Yancey's books are well known to, I imagine, everyone here. He's sold over 18 million copies. He's written 25 books, and I have every single one of his books on my bookshelf. In fact, I brought them here as a visual aid. There they are. In fact, I didn't have them all, but last time he came, he very kindly filled in the very small gaps that I had and sent me the other copies. So I do now have every copy. And this one you'll see, particularly well-thumbed copy of What is So Amazing About Grace. This is a book we recommend to every single person that comes on Alpha. It's a fantastic book. If you haven't read it yet, it's life-changing. But today I want to focus on really his first book and his last book, both of which are on the subject of suffering, and that's what I'm going to be particularly asking him about today. So, Philip, it's such a privilege to have you both here with us. And the book I want to recommend is this book, which Pips and I have just been reading, The Question That Never Goes Away. This is the US edition, this is the UK edition. Why? And Philip's first book was on that subject, Where is God When It Hurts? And then recently he's visited, well, tell us about the three places that you have visited.
Because I wrote my first book, Where is God When It Hurts, I'm often asked to speak on that very question. And I've been to some very wrenching places, Virginia Tech after the shootings there, Mumbai. We happened to be in Mumbai, India, the night of the bombings. A spontaneous meeting happened. I had to speak again. And at the end of 2012, I thought back over that year. There were three places of extraordinary but very different kinds of suffering. The first was Japan. It was the one-year anniversary of the tsunami. And they asked me to come and visit the area that had been affected and speak to a national prayer meeting. Then that was in March. In September, I went to Sarajevo, the former Yugoslavia, which was the scene of the terrible war in the Balkans. 4-year siege around this town, 10,000 people died, just one horrible story after another of what humans did to each other. And then the last one was the smallest in scale, but in many ways the most poignant and the most difficult for me. And that was in Newtown, Connecticut, the scene of the Sandy Hook elementary school shootings where 26 and 7-year-old children and then 6 teachers and staff were killed. And a former Brit, Clive Calver, who was the director of the Evangelical Alliance here for years in Britain, is now the pastor of a church right on the border on the city limits of Newtown, Connecticut. It's one of the few thriving evangelical churches in that part of the world, 3,500 members. And he called and asked, could you possibly come and speak again on this topic. So 1977 was a long time ago. How many of you were not alive in 1977? Yeah, okay. That was my first book, and I wrote that book because, like a lot of people, it was a barrier to my faith. I couldn't get past this question, if there is a good God, why do these bad things happen? Years later, in 2012, I had spent a lot of time with people who have gone through that tragedy, and I wanted to write a new book about things I had learned from them. Not so much the personal quest of trying to figure it out for myself, but how we as a church can and should respond to people who go through great tragedy.
And it's not just, of course, seeing those great tragedies out there, but it's also a very personal thing. And you start the book by telling the story about your own father. Just tell us about that.
Yes, I was only 1 year old. My father is an extraordinary man. I never knew him because he died that year. He was planning to be a missionary to Africa, and like a lot of missionaries, had accumulated a mailing list and was raising funds and getting people to pray for him. In 1950, he contracted polio. That was the great feared disease back then. In the U.S., 50,000 people a year were dying from polio. He was healthy and strong, but suddenly he was paralyzed. In fact, he was so paralyzed he could not even breathe on his own. So he was put in one of the iron lung machines that does your breathing for you. And the people who were praying for him, they couldn't understand how God could possibly take a person like that with such a future ahead of him. So they became convinced that he would be healed. They prayed, believed he would be healed. And against all the doctor's advice, he was removed from the iron lung as an act of faith, and about a week later he died. And I lived my whole life under the cloud, and the way that affected my mother, those around us, our family.
So how old was he when he died?
He was 24. Mm-hmm. And
how old were you?
I was one. Yeah, just a year old. So I have no memories of him, no conscious memories. The only thing I have of his is a Bible in which he records in the flyleaf one person after another whom he led to Christ. So he was an extraordinary person with great potential. And what I learned from that is what we believe about this question matters. If we get it wrong, it can really lead to bad things, as happened in my own family.
Now, of course, there have been many things in your life, challenges and so on, but one that was a particular challenge is when you broke your neck, and the questions that you asked at that time.
Yes, I was on a book tour speaking. Who knew book tours could be so dangerous? And in a neighboring state, driving back, I live in Colorado. It's a state of full of mountains, as you probably know if you've been there. And going around one of those mountains in February, I hit a patch of ice, and the car I was driving went off the side of the road, turned over 5 times like this. I was belted in, fortunately, and didn't know how hurt I was. Was taken to a little clinic, and it was a good doctor, but if they still teach courses in bedside manner, he flunked. Because I'm lying there, and he comes in and says, "Well, Mr. Yancey, you've got a broken neck." So, oh, well, that's bad. Yeah, but it could be worse, because, you see, it's not right next to the spinal cord, so you're not in any immediate danger of paralysis. Oh, well, that's good. Well, yes, but it's right next to the carotid artery, so actually you're in immediate danger of dying. Oh, that's bad. He literally did. And he said, "We've got a jet standing by to fly you to Denver, because this is a small town, for emergency surgery. But just between you and me, if the carotid artery has been punctured, you're not going to make it to Denver. So here's a mobile phone. You should call the people you love and tell them goodbye, just in case." So as it turned out, for the next 7 hours, I was strapped down as they were doing arterial dyes and all these different procedures to find out how hurt I was. He did free one arm so I could call the people that I loved and tell them goodbye. And that was a hallmark experience in my life, Nikki.
Yeah. And what were the big questions for you at that moment?
Yes. I'm sitting there thinking, okay, let's see. I made my living as a Christian writer. This could be my last hour. I need to come up with something here. And what occurred to me is that so much of what we spend our lives worrying about, how does the lawn look, what kind of car do I drive, how much money is in my pension fund, how many books have I sold, those did not occur to me for the next 7 hours. In fact, as I lay there, I could only think of 3 questions that were worth my time. One was, who do I love? Who will I call on that mobile phone and tell them goodbye? Who do I love? What have I done with my life, and am I ready for whatever is next? Those were the only 3 questions worth my time. And I, later reflecting back, realized we should all be living in light of those questions every day. But we get so distracted by just the busyness, the to-do list, all of that we let those sink into the background. And this traumatic experience really put them into the foreground for me, and I've tried to learn from that, not every day as urgently, but to live in light of those questions ever since.
Yeah, so just think of the message that he's got to share about pain and suffering and facing death, the question of who do I love? Oh, did my life count for anything? Those kind of questions are huge and are ones that people will ask. And they're thinking, if I was in that situation, those would be the questions that I ask. Now, this method of using intriguing questions is powerful. Another person who is very, very good at that is Dr. Lloyd John Ogilvy, a longtime pastor of Hollywood Presbyterian Church. And then he became the chaplain of the United States Senate. And he used this method often when he was pastor of a church. He would send out a thing to his congregation saying, "Let me know what your greatest questions are." And then he would take those questions and he would develop messages, and then he'd put those messages in a book. Here's 2 of them. "Asking God Your Hardest Questions" by Lloyd J. Ogilvy. Or, this I think was the first one that he did this way, "Ask Him Anything. God Can Handle Your Hardest Questions." And so in there are questions about, can I forgive someone? Why do children die of starvation in this world? Tough questions, but they're the kind of questions that stick with you, that make you say, I want to know more about that. I want to know the answer to that question. That's the point of using an intriguing question as your introduction. Now, Jesus was somebody who was a pro at this, as he is in so many things. Let's just look at a few of the questions he asked. Matthew 16, he says, who do people say the Son of Man is? The picture is that the disciples and Jesus are kind of walking along, and Jesus just asked this rather intriguing question. Who do people say I am? And the answer is, well, some say you're John the Baptist, come back to life. Some say you're a prophet, you're Elijah, or one of the prophets that you come back to life. And then the big question, well, who do you say that I am? And it's Peter who answers, and you remember he answers, you are, depending on the translation, God's Messiah, or you are the Messiah, or you are the Christ. And here's Jesus' response. Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And then he goes on to say, and on this rock I will build my church. Now, you can debate on your theological background about what Jesus meant there. Did he mean Peter was the rock, or did he mean that confession that Jesus is the Christ? But notice how Jesus used the intriguing question to get at that question of, how will I build my church? Well, I'm going to build it on people who acknowledge that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, there are all sorts, if you look online and put in questions that Jesus asked, you can get all kinds of responses there. But just look at some of these that he used as an intro to messages. Here's seven of them. Do you believe that I am able to do this? Now, that was a question asked of a blind man that was coming asking for healing. And the issue was faith. Do you have faith? And then that becomes a discourse on faith. Why are you afraid, O you of little faith? That was in a storm, and the disciples are afraid, and it becomes an occasion to teach on faith. What do you think about the Christ? Now, that's a fascinating, intriguing question, because it was asked of the Pharisees. And he used that to jump off on a message from the Old Testament about the Christ and how David calls him his Lord, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It becomes a marvelous teaching moment. Do you love me? That's the question, intriguing question, that Jesus asked Peter after Peter had denied the Lord. John 21 is Peter's restoration into ministry. But the whole message of, you know, I want you to turn, I want you to feed my sheep, I want you to feed my lambs, began with that question, do you love me? Or number five there, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I tell you? That's the end of the Sermon on the Plain. It's the counterpart to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 to 7. And in this message, Jesus is talking about a variety of ways to live. And then he's saying to the people there, why am I teaching you and you're not doing it? And then he gives that wonderful parable about the house built on the sand, and the rains come, and, you know, and it falls. And there's the house built on the rock, and it can withstand any storm. And so that question becomes the lead-in to a great message on obedience. What do you want me to do for you? Again, a blind person. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Becomes the message on judgment. Don't judge. Don't judge people. And instead, you know, look at yourself, etc. So these are the kind of questions that Jesus asked. In fact, many have written books about them. Here's one by a man named Butch. What's the name there? Butrickett. It's where he took these questions of Jesus, developed messages on them, etc. So think about intriguing questions. What are the intriguing questions that might serve as a beginning to a message, as a hook to draw people in to say, I want to know more. I want to know the answer to that question. Here are some I've used at various times. Why does God allow children to die of starvation? That's a question that torments me at times in my prayers for children in Africa where there's drought and numbers are incredible. Why does God allow children to die of starvation? I use that wonderfully, powerfully at a time when the statistics showed that one child dies every 7 seconds in the United States because of starvation or starvation-related diseases. And so what I had at the beginning of the message was somebody just started ringing a bell. And every little, just a very quiet tinkle. And it was in the back of the auditorium, and they just stood there for my message, and every 7 seconds just went ding. 7 seconds later, ding. And sometimes, when I first started it, I told them what was going to happen, and then I asked the question, why does God allow children to die of starvation? Ding. Ding. And just stood there silent for about 15 seconds so that the bell had rung twice before I went on to say how we're going to answer that and began looking at Scripture. It was a powerful way of introducing the sovereignty of God, but also the desire that He has for us to be involved in solving the problems and bringing the kingdom of God to fruition today by being engaged in His work. Can I really forgive and forget? I introduced with that message holding a sledgehammer because at one point I was so angry at someone, I found that I was working with a counselor who told me you've got to externalize your anger, and so I would take my sledgehammer in the backyard and just pound on the ground with it. And I was so angry at somebody that I thought had betrayed me, had mistreated me. And so the question was, okay, who's done that to you? Does God forgive me, even if I do the same sin over and over, to find a way to mix that with an intriguing way of bringing people in? Is God really in control? All you got to do is get some headlines of newspapers where you live or the news of the world right now, and you say, is God really in control? These are ways that God can use to catch people's attention through you. And so as you think of your message, we're going to get to how you develop the body of the message in a couple of lessons. But as you think about your message, think about an intriguing question sometimes that might hook people in. So this is another way to hook people in. It's a good way to do introductions. We'll continue this discussion next time.